Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, a personal account from the major South Asia earthquake region. An analyst speaks with us about the Syrian president's remarks on the conflict in his nation. An author stresses the importance of teaching children to understand kids with disabilities.
It really needs to be done in a fun but educational way.
And pop singer Justin Timberlake garners a special award. It's right here on The Voice of America. A major earthquake has hit northern Afghanistan, sending tremors through Pakistan and India. Correspondent Ayaz Ghul is in Islamabad and joins us on the line. Welcome, Ayaz.
My pleasure.
Please tell us about the damage.
Well, it seems that there has been extensive damage, particularly in northwestern Pakistan. I mean, the area which borders Afghanistan, and we know that the epicenter of the earthquake was located in Afghanistan. So the northwestern mountainous region of Pakistan suffered the most. You know, it's mainly in this part of Pakistan. It's not very well developed area, and mostly it's mud houses, and the structures, especially residential structures, are not that strong enough to sustain this kind of a shock. I mean, the way the earthquake shook entire Pakistan, we could imagine that there must have been a lot of damage. But because it's nighttime and the earthquake happened in the late afternoon, so obviously it will take some time before the authorities come up with some real assessment of exactly what kind of damage that has occurred in that area. And we have been told that maybe by Tuesday morning, the military missions that have been dispatched to the area to assess the damage will be able to provide some initial reports.
Tell us about your personal experience.
Well, it was really a very strong tremor. You know, as soon as it hit, I mean, it was a terrible. I was sitting on the second, on the first floor of my house with my kids, and we all had to just flee the home. We were just thinking maybe it's going to come down on us, and we just went outside in the street where hundreds of people had already gathered. At the, you know, the way this thing started, we didn't feel initially, but we realized once we were on the street that people were already afraid of it and scared, and they were all gathered there, and we were with them. But we could see then, you know, the way the windows were shaking and our houses, the entire houses, you know, back and forth, they were swinging here and there. And it was quite an amazing scene to have experienced, because it continued. The earthquake persisted for about a minute, and it was quite intense. And it was really, I mean, we were scared, and it took us a while before we came back to our homes, because everybody was scared maybe it will come back again. So it was quite a terrible experience that not only we personally experienced, but all over Pakistan, especially those areas which were hit by the earthquake. And it reminded us of the kind of experience we have had in 2005 of October, on October 8th in that year. And that was also the epicenter of that earthquake was not far from Islamabad, and it shook us at that time. But today's, because the duration was so long, that it really scared everybody.
Well, thank you very much, Ayaz, for sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
This South Asia quake is all over social media today with tweets, photos, and more. Mufti Ismail Menk writes, "May the Almighty ease the burden of those affected in the earthquake in northern Afghanistan and Pakistan. Our prayers go out to all involved." Hamza Khan tweets, "Earthquake steals test match victory happiness. God be with those affected and bless the souls departed." Dives Lamichan says, "Thoughts to the families of earthquake departed souls in Pak and Afghan. As a Nepal earthquake survivor, I know how that feels." Sarah Vasan Kanan notes, "Tuesday is full moon and earthquake happened today." Saad Rafique tweets, "Try not to politicize things. It was a natural calamity. This is a time when unity will sort things out quicker than divisions." Riz Khan writes, "General Rahil has ordered Pak Army to voluntarily help earthquake hit areas without waiting for any order." Snober Alan Abbasi tweets, "Let's pray for all the people that have been affected by this earthquake. Can't imagine people losing everything in just seconds." And, of course, it is our lead story on our website, voanews.com. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
British researchers say they've come up with a new blood test that could help doctors provide cancer patients with the most appropriate treatment for their particular form of the disease. By running these new blood tests at times throughout a patient's treatment, medical professionals will be able to quickly and easily monitor the cancer's progress to see if the selected therapy is working or if a new plan should be devised. They say that their new blood test filters out a tumor's DNA from a patient's blood, so the tumor's genetic makeup can be analyzed and doctors can tailor treatments to the cancer cells. The researchers say that since tumors and their genetic makeup are unique and evolve, doctors need to understand their characteristics and changes so that they can develop the best treatment possible for their patients. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad told a visiting Russian parliamentary delegation Sunday he wants to eliminate the terrorist threat to his country as part of a political solution to ending his country's nearly five-year-old civil war. My colleague Victor Beatty is following this story and joins us here in the studio. Welcome, Victor.
Thank you, Susan. Well, the state-run Sun On news agency said on Sunday Mr. Assad said taking out terror groups would preserve Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity. A Russian lawmaker also said the Syrian leader was prepared to take part in new elections if that's what the Syrian people want. Mr. Assad won a third seven-year term last year in a vote held only in areas controlled by the government and was boycotted by the opposition. Regional analyst Joseph Olmert of the University of South Carolina told me there was nothing new in what Mr. Assad said on Sunday.
He refers to all the opposition in Syria, which is most of the Syrian people, as terrorist, and of course he uses the word because he wants to justify through the use of the word terrorist all the harsh measures that his regime is taking against the Syrian people, but also to try and flatter public opinion in the West by referring to the opponents as the opposition, his opponents, as terrorists, and all the baggage that comes with it. So I don't think that there is anything new here. But for the fact that he may feel a bit more secure these days due to the Russian intervention, even though I must tell you that a lot of things happening in Syria on the ground, which are not coming to the attention of the Western media in various areas of the country, which indicate to me that as of now, the real actual situation on the ground there hasn't changed in a dramatic way or in a fundamental way.
In other words, the recent government gains are questionable?
I'm not sure that there are any government gains. You know, there are reports about some gains, and then you have to bear in mind that it already happened in the past. What happens is that the Syrian army is so small, dwarfed by the defections and the refusal of Sunni youngsters to be drafted. I mean, it's not that they refuse, they simply don't go to the army. So even if they take over a piece of land, they can't hold on for it for a long time because they don't have enough troops in other parts of the country. So now they have, of course, more support from the Iranians and from Shia militias from outside of Syria, mainly from Iraq. But look, these are foreigners. They are not local Syrians. This is not doing good service to the regime. So we have to look at all this from a context of time perspective, not just to judge events by what's happening right now on the ground.
Joseph Olmert says there is no question in his mind a unified Syria is a thing of the past. He says majority Sunnis and pro-Assad Alawites are embittered, and there is no chance they'll live under one ruler.
Thank you, Victor.
All right, Susan.
The runoff election of the independent candidates in the first round of Egyptian parliamentary elections is on schedule this week, but the official results of the political party list indicate that the big winner is a pro-government electoral list of parties headed by a former intelligence general, taking 60 seats out of the 120. If that happens again in the second round next month, the new Egyptian parliament's largest bloc will be overwhelmingly supporting Egyptian President Sisi and may even form the new government. International Edition's Mohamed El-Shenawy is following these developments. Welcome. Mohamed, Egyptian President Sisi promised the Egyptian people to restore democracy with an elected parliament that has a strong mandate by the new constitution. What happened to that promise?
As many experts say, it was manipulated by the election law, which was designed to sideline political parties by earmarking 20% only of the seats for the party lists and 75% for independent candidates. So there is no real political opposition in the new parliament. The promise seems to be not genuine, as Ahmed Shaheen, professor of political science at Georgetown University, explains.
Since Sisi came to power, he has been depoliticizing the Egyptian system, the Egyptian process, and the Egyptian political dynamics. He's trying to actually demobilize and depoliticize the system. And I think this is one of the results or the consequences of his strategy at the moment. The 2012 and 2014 constitutions, they give the parliament considerable amount of power, relatively speaking. So I think this will be used, this low turnout will be used by Sisi and his regime to try to point out to the new deputies that he's much more legitimate than them, that he won with 98%, whereas they come with very low legitimacy and very low turnout. So I think, you know, this will be used to undermine the legislative monitoring, overseeing powers of the new parliament.
Professor Shaheen said it is obviously that the new parliament is going to be predominantly a pro-Sisi legislature, and the first assignment for that parliament would be to ratify all the laws that Sisi single-handedly issued in the absence of a parliament. Shaheen added that the new parliament will also amend the constitution in order to create strong presidential executive system by stripping the parliament from some of its powerful monitoring authorities.
So with the ability to take to the streets no longer a possibility, and with no pressure from the international community, how would Egypt see a real transition to democracy?
Well, that's a very good question, Sue. But experts see no room for a political change in Egypt for years to come, waiting for a totally different set of dynamics, according to Professor Shaheen.
One is a need for a strong, solid coalition from civilian politicians that will include the various colors of the political spectrum in Egypt. This has to emerge that can counterweight the hegemony of the military and the elements of the old regime and those who are, you know, supporting this kind of autocracy and authoritarianism and so on. The second thing is eventually the military will come to a realization that it cannot fix the system alone. This is exactly the realization that the militaries in Chile, in Spain, in Portugal, in Argentina, everywhere in Brazil, everywhere in the 70s, of course, realized. So they have to go into a process of self-reform, and they have to take one or two steps back in order to allow civilians actually to manage the political process and the economy. And we all know that the militaries do not build democracy, and they are not the right engine for building a political process.
Obviously, Professor Shaheen is talking about a long-term process that might take so many years before Egypt can witness a real transition to democracy.
Thank you, Mohammed.
Thank you, Sue, for having me.
Coming up on International Edition, helping kids understand challenged kids. And hometown music boy makes it big, very big. Children so often don't understand other children with disabilities. It can leave them frightened and even lead to bullying. Anya Dameron, author of the book Super Kids, has some suggestions on how to communicate to young ones about those with disabilities. And she joins us on the line. Hi, Anya.
Hi.
Hi. What can parents, and for that matter, anyone dealing with children, do to help with this problem?
Well, I think that teaching your children about disabilities can be a huge challenge. It needs to be done in a way that the children can comprehend and doesn't feel awkward. It really needs to be done in a fun but educational way. That's why we created this book. We were trying to make it easier to talk about disabilities because we as parents, teachers, uncles, grandmas, it's very hard to talk about this with kids. It's like an awkward moment. And trying to make it normal, I think it's the best. Trying to teach them that we're not the same. Everyone is unique, that we all have differences, that we all have weaknesses, and pointing them to what's positive about everyone else, I think it's the best way.
Could you give us a tip on one way to help accomplish this?
I think that we could start by showing the kids all the things that disability children or people do that we don't, all the things they can do, the positive things that they develop, that they learn to be able to be around us. Like, for example, a girl that can speak with her hands or a boy that can read with his hands. Stuff like that can make them curious and can change the way they see disability people.
And what age should you start talking to your children about other children with disabilities?
I think that you can start, like, since they're very little. Like, we just made a picture book about it. From 3 years old, you can start reading it to them. And the sooner the better, because then it's normal for them to talk about that.
Okay, well, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Pop singer Justin Timberlake has garnered a special award. VOA's Jim Stevenson has this report.
Justin Timberlake's music doesn't bring Memphis, Tennessee exactly to mind.
Said all I want from you is to see you tomorrow. And every tomorrow, maybe you're letting me borrow your heart.
But Memphis is his hometown. He was inducted into the Memphis Music Hall of Fame.
I'm serious. This is the coolest thing that's ever happened to me. The Grammys are political. The Emmys are political. Memphis is not political. And don't get me started on Hollywood.
Timberlake's 20-minute speech served as a tribute to the city that is home to Beale Street, Stax Records, and is an epicenter of the blues and soul.
I felt like it was sort of unwarranted when I first looked at the list of my fellow inductees. But I've also never been one to turn down a reason to come home and spend time in the city that I grew up in and that holds such a special place in my heart. I also don't turn down free awards, so this all worked out.
Memphis is known for great R&B and soul artists like Sam and Dave. Otis Redding.
Sitting in the morning sun. I'll be sitting when the evening comes.
And Al Green.
It's all in a day.
Justin Timberlake performed covers of those artists' songs while at the city's Cannon Center for a crowd of about 2,000.
I've been all over the world 13 times. But London ain't got no Gus's fried chicken.
You know what I'm saying?
Paris may rendezvous, but they ain't got no rendezvous. Egypt has the pyramids. They don't have a Bass Pro Pyramid.
It won't be the last musical award for Timberlake, but likely will remain one of the most special for him. In Washington, I'm Jim Stevenson.
Don't act like it's a bad thing to fall in love with me. Zoom around and find your dreams come true with me. Spend all your time and your money just to find out that my love was free. So don't act like it's a bad thing to fall in love with me.
I like that Timberlake guy. I think he must be pretty neat. And it certainly wouldn't be a bad thing to fall in love with him, that's for sure. He's got the looks, the money, the moves. He's got everything. Anyway, we don't listen to an old woman. We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner. Then scroll down to International Edition. And if you go there and you want to see something from a couple months ago, you can do that. There's a little calendar where you can click on the calendar and then the date that you want to listen, and just click away to your heart's content and you'll find it. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States remains concerned about the arrest of Venezuelan opposition leader Manuel Rosales. Mr. Rosales was detained by authorities October 15th when he returned to Venezuela after 6 years in self-imposed exile. A judge has reportedly ordered that Mr. Morales remain in jail until a verdict is reached in a trial scheduled to start November 12th. Mr. Rosales ran against former President Hugo Chavez in the 2006 presidential election. He left the country amid allegations of corruption, which he claims were politically motivated. Mr. Rosales returned to Venezuela to be present for the country's December 6th parliamentary elections. The arrest of Mr. Rosales follows the detention of several opposition leaders and reinforces a pattern of criminalizing political dissent by the Venezuelan government. Among those politicians jailed is Leopoldo Lopez, who was sentenced in September to nearly 14 years in prison on charges of having incited people to violence using subliminal messages. The case was called a travesty of justice by Human Rights Watch, which said the Venezuelan prosecution never presented basic evidence of a crime. Speaking to the press about Mr. Rosales's arrest, U.S. State Department Deputy Spokesperson Mark Toner called on the Venezuelan government to respect due process for Rosales and all others imprisoned on politically motivated charges. The Venezuelan government has an obligation, he said, to respect the human rights and fundamental freedoms guaranteed by international law. Deputy Spokesperson Toner noted that as a longtime party to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, Venezuela is required to promptly inform all persons detained of the reasons and any charges against them, and to promptly bring anyone detained on criminal charges before a judge, and to either release them or guarantee them a fair and public trial before an independent and impartial tribunal. Consistent with the values and the spirit of the Inter-American Democratic Charter, we call upon the government of Venezuela to provide Rosales and others in political opposition with the legal protections and due process to which they are entitled.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.